This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Hello, welcome to the celebration of research here at UC San Diego. My name is Mark Hanna. I study early American history as well as the history of the British Empire. Here I teach courses on surveys of early American history as well as the golden age of piracy and the age of sail. I'm also the honorary curator of the Hill Collection of Pacific Voyages, and I'm the founding associate director of the Institute of Arts and Humanities, recently begun here in July. Today I'm going to briefly talk about my recent book, Pirate Nests and the Rise of the British Empire, 1570 to 1740, and then I'm going to relate it to my experience teaching here at UC San Diego. They don't actually commit acts of piracy, but you'll see. Pirate Nests analyzes the rise and subsequent fall of international piracy from the perspective of colonial maritime communities. Depictions of pirates in popular culture, as well as in serious historical works, traditionally depicts pirates as simply swashbuckling adventurers relegated to a life at sea. After years of research, I found that early modern piracy flourished in the Caribbean, the Pacific, and the Indian Ocean, because of the active support it received from colonial maritime communities and the merchant elite living on land. Far from a hindrance to trade, these fledgling maritime communities thrive from the active support of global piracy committed against traditional enemies, nominally at peace with England. In times of economic distress, these men represented a real as well as a symbolic challenge to the legal and commercial policies formulated by a distant and often ineffectual administrative body back in London. They considered them these policies that hindered prosperity and often the defense of the colonies. Although pirates could be found in nearly every Atlantic port city, only particular locations at particular moments earned international reputations as pirate nests, which is a pejorative term used by royal officials. Many of the most notorious pirates began their careers in these ports, while many others settled down there to become respected members of the local elite. So by focusing on the relationship of high seas marauding with landed communities, we have to rethink everything we thought we knew about piracy during its golden age, which is roughly 1570 to 1740. More importantly, this connection forces us to rethink how we imagine maritime history as a largely deep sea project. And of course, it's very appropriate to be here in Birch Aquarium, people who study the deep sea. This book tells an entirely new story about the tumultuous early formation of the British Empire and the essential role that maritime depredation and violence played in the development of what would eventually become the United States. One way of thinking about this is based on the image that's on the cover of my book. This is Robert Rich, the second Earl of Warwick. He inherited a fleet of ships from his very wealthy father. He was a Puritan. He doesn't look like a Puritan in this picture, but that's, Puritans are not necessarily the way you imagine it. When he inherited this fleet of ships, he sent his captains out plundering the Mughal Empire in the Indian Ocean, and then subsequently the Spanish and Portuguese Catholic shipping in the Atlantic. Yet at the same time, his pirate captains also were essential in the formation of the first English communities, transporting the first immigrants to Jamestown, to Bermuda, New Plymouth, Massachusetts Bay, and Jamaica. They provided an essential supply line to those founding colonies, and their plunder provided financial backing to those endeavors. There was no money to be made in Jamestown, in New Plymouth. The money was made plundering in the Caribbean. So they did that along their way. So I purposely picked someone who supported pirates, not an actual pirate, for the cover of my book, because that's what I was really interested in. And I picked someone who was really interested in colonization and radical Protestantism, as well as plunder, because they were deeply interrelated. My book traces the transformation of colonial communities from centuries of support to the period where they were no longer supported between 1716 to 1726, a period known as the War on Pirates, when colonial communities actually began to hunt pirates rather than support them. And during this period, scores of pirates were executed along the North American seaboard. If pirates were actively supported during the years prior to 1716, really a century and a half, it begs a very simple question that many of my students ask, is Is it true that somehow pirates were different than common sailors or even the local communities that supported them on land? In fact, the popular imagination of pirates is radically different from other sailors, has contributed to the notion that they spoke their own language, hence the success of International Talk Like a Pirate Day. Does anybody know about this? It actually is an international movement. September 19th, every single year. It also contributes to the idea that if you actually go to your Facebook page, you can change the language to pirates. Do people know this too? Okay. My work actually challenges this to an extent. In fact, the way you think pirates speak actually comes from this man, Robert Newton, who decided when he was playing Long John Silver in the 1950 Treasure Island movie, he decided to go R for the first time. Before that, no one really did this. So this one person changed the history of piracy. So from the period before 1716, it actually makes more sense to describe someone as a sailor who had committed an act of piracy in a long and complicated and varied career rather than a static image of a pirate. Right? Because people ask me all the time, do pirates look like this, speak like this? Instead, think of it, piracy as an act in a long, complex career. Another way of thinking about this is imagine a child stealing candy, you know, at age 12, and they're caught by their parents, and they're embarrassed, and they're punished. But then they go on to live a nice, fruitful life. They go through adulthood without ever committing an act of theft again. It'd be ludicrous to look at that person and call them a thief. Right? And imagine if this person grows up, gets a PhD, and becomes a well-known historian. You'd rather call them a professor and rather than an actual criminal. And this is true of piracy. People committed acts of piracy among a long spectrum of behaviors. So certainly there were a number of wild captains of legendary status who would never consider legitimate commerce as a way of life. But there were far more who hoped to settle down on land and at least receive a pardon, which in fact was remarkably common. One pirate even married the daughter of the governor of Pennsylvania. So with so many welcoming ports, a merry life, yet a short one, was not the motto of most pirates during the 17th century. My book is based on archival research performed throughout the United States, Great Britain, as well as Bermuda. And much of that research was performed with the help, generous help, of UC San Diego and the Academic Senate. I'll give you just one example, with time constraints, of a kind of document that I read, and one I found in the British Library. What you're looking at is a petition from the wives of pirates who were based in Madagascar plundering the Indian Ocean in 1708. These women begged to have their husbands sent home because they couldn't take care of their families, and they were saying, we're in poverty. Our husbands are incredibly wealthy. If you send them home, we'll give the treasury half of what they have, and the other half we'll keep and take care of our families. These men knew that returning to London was actually never going to happen. It wasn't an option for most sea rovers. But they knew that the North American colonies was an option, and many did move to places like Newport, Rhode Island, and Charleston, South Carolina. One name that's interesting is the very first name to sign this petition. You can see there in the very bottom left, if you can see that there. The name is Mary Read, and some of you might know or recognize the name Mary Read. Mary Read is the name of an actual female pirate. It's a woman we know she lived. She was executed for piracy in 1721. We have her trial record. We can imagine if she was a woman whose husband became a pirate in the Indian Ocean, was never pardoned after her petition. So she herself took to the seas in revenge of her husband's inability to ever come home. Is this true? I don't know. It can't be for certain. But it is amazing to imagine the possibility. So my goal has been to put men who committed acts of piracy, committed piratical acts, into their very specific historical context, rather than categorize them as a simple or static pirate. As a historian, I try to understand why someone in Rhode Island could feel comfortable welcoming a sailor who arrived in a Newport tavern with Arabian gold, clearly stolen by violence from an allied shipping, the Mughal Empire in India. This is an actual piece of gold found in a dig site in Rhode Island. The knee-jerk reaction is to assume, of course, this is all about corruption and greed. But the more time I spent in archives, the more I realized that it was about much more than that. My book provides a wide array of particular contexts, from a loose legal system surrounding maritime warfare, a political regime that put a great deal of power in local governors over a distant monarch, an economic system that seemed crippling, a corrupt East India Company monopoly that prevented the colonial gentry from acquiring heavily desired luxury goods like silk and calico. So understanding context requires honing a historian's most important skill, which is empathy. And I mean to grasp the full context of someone's life from the past, someone so incredibly far and distant from you. Again, this is not the same as sympathy. I don't ask my students to feel bad for people in the past. Oh, it smelled bad back in the day, and they were always in pain. This is a skill I think that every one of our undergraduates needs to work on every single day of their lives. And this is what historians do for a living, and we are in many ways the best to train them to do so. I have to, in fact, perform a radical form of empathy in the sense that I have to understand the context for the violent actions of pirates like Blackbeard, a man who tied matchsticks to the ends of the curls at the ends of his beard so that when he boarded a ship, his face was engulfed in smoke. Right? Especially following such a divisive election, where those who did not vote with you seem to inhabit a wholly separate universe from your own, it's imperative to invoke your power of empathy to grasp why they voted the way they did. Again, this is not a call for sympathy, but to understand the context. And empathy is essential in a well-functioning democracy. In my courses, I have my students work on their ability to empathize with those in the past by trying to construct their own histories based on original documents and sources from the past. History is in part the story that we tell based on the evidence we have available to us. I tell my students to come with what I call willful naivete. And what I mean by that is they have so many preconceptions about the history of piracy, what piracy is all about, what pirates look like. And I say, erase everything. Start fresh. And then you're going to go into the archive and you're going to read the original documents. And then you are going to become historians and you're going to make history and you're going to describe what we know about pirates based on the history that you construct. UCSD is uniquely situated to do this kind of tactile experience because we happen to have one of the greatest collections of original documents on the history of piracy in our special collections library. And many of these are part of the Hill Collection of Pacific Voyages, where I am the curator. Linda Clausen, who is here over in the corner, wait, put your hand up real quick, Linda. Linda Clausen, who is here, and her team of diligent librarians help my students find and work with documents so they themselves can make history. Sometimes we purchase manuscript materials like original ship's logbooks that have never been analyzed by historians before. And they might have been sitting in someone's attic for centuries. Our students then might be the first to uncover these invaluable treasures for future scholars. Sometimes empathizing with life at sea is really hard to do in a seminar room. So sometimes you have to take your students to sea. Again, UC San Diego is uniquely situated to provide that unforgettable experience because we happen to live only a few miles from one of the world's greatest maritime museums. Students in my Age of Sail course can actually handle sail aboard the Californian, which is the official tall ship of the state of California. And here you see faculty, graduate students, and undergraduates all working together equally before the mast. Soon, my students will be able to sail on the remarkable San Salvador, which is a replica of the first European ship sailed by Juan Cabrillo into San Diego Harbor in 1542. And if you haven't seen it, I ask you to please go downtown and check it out. I have not actually been sailing on it yet, because I don't think I'm allowed to, but I've been on it, so very soon. And then during the summer, we're actually going to host an event that will involve UCSD alumni and donors to go in the San Salvador, and I will be there, so you're welcome to join us. These voyages are captained by UC San Diego alumnus and director of the Maritime Museum, Ray Ashley, who's a very good friend of UCSD campus and has been a very good friend of mine. This kind of community engagement is only one part of a broad vision plan for the new Institute of Arts and Humanities founded this summer, where I am the associate director. We support programming that brings UC San Diego to the community and the community to UC San Diego. To empathize is to try to understand what it means to be human and what it is that we all share. And this is what the new Institute of Arts and Humanities is all about. So let me conclude by asking if you have any questions about piracy, about the archives, and about the new Institute of Arts and Humanities. And thank you for being here tonight. How many undergraduates are history majors? The answer is not enough. That's my mathematical answer. In fact, we have one of the strongest history departments in the country. Arts and humanities, I think, they were 33 in the U.S. News and World Report last year. They're now 23. 23 in the world, arts and humanities. 23 in the world. Just let that sink in for a second. And yet we're considered a STEM school. 23 in the world, and we're a STEM school. So in many ways, this has been a frustration. And we really need you all to go out there and be proselytized for the arts and humanities, to go out there on our behalf and speak for us. And the fact that this is not self-evident. Yes. In my own work, I talk about it in my class. So the question was, do I talk about Pacific pirates at all in my own work? I do a little bit in my class. I'm actually working on an article project that does involve Chinese pirates from the early 18th century, and there actually were a number of female Chinese pirates who were very well known. Lady Chang, who was actually leading. But one question that I have, though, about this is, one of the questions about piracy is this question of scale. Once you get to 100,000 people, are they pirates anymore, or is that a nation state? And that actually is a question I have sometimes with South China, which is, are these pirates or are these called pirates because the emperor considers them pirates, or is this a separate political regime? So the general question was about the significance of the Barbary pirates to the sort of the formation of the early Republic, early America, to an extent. So Barbary pirates were part. I write about them. It's in the book. It's an important part of the book, but I don't talk about the early Republic. But I talk about an earlier period. The Barbary pirates were pirates based in North Africa, the city-states of places like Algiers, Tunis, Marmora, which is part of Morocco, and Tripoli. And they preyed upon Mediterranean shipping. A lot of this had to do with the part of the post-Reconquista period, meaning after the Spanish booted out North Africans, and they were sort of had a period of long centuries of revenge against Christian shipping. And this continued for centuries. And the period after the American Revolution, all of a sudden, the British Royal Navy was no longer protecting American ships, and Americans were forced to fight the Barbary pirates. So really the first war in defense of the United States was a war against the Barbary pirates. And so that is very true. That actually was, I'll tell you what's important about it as the formation, for the formation of the United States. It was one of the first really unifying moments. It was one of the first moments where Virginians and Bostonians could actually share something together that they were equally afraid of, which is captivity to Barbary pirates. So the question was, what motivates pirates, right? So, In my book, I actually talk about multiple motivations. Obviously, greed is going to be a motivation. You're going to be inspired to obtain riches to an extent. But there are many other motivations, and there are other justifications. Many of it had to do with religion. And one of the reasons I brought up Robert Rich, he felt justified in sending his captains out around the world because he was a radical Protestant. And he really felt like part of the Reformation was attacking Islam. So he felt justified in sending his ships out to the Indian Ocean. As part of the radical Reformation, he felt like attacking Catholicism was necessary as part of the Reformation. So he felt comfortable attacking the Spanish and Portuguese. So this man felt very justified in religious purposes for what he did. Religion is brought up all the time, and it's a justification among others. Other issues, again, justifications or motivations, again, would have been imperial, just imperial contests, that the desires to take one island from another island or seize parts of Panama. So there's big, broad questions that have to do with imperialism, religion, politics, and then smaller ones that are individual greed and self-desire. So welcome, thank you all, and enjoy the rest of your evening tonight.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.